Good morning. So before we get started today, just wanted to take a minute to thank all of you for the messages and cards and support and food and prayers that we've received over the last week. This last week has been, as you might expect, incredibly difficult. But I think of the analogies that Paul uses in the New Testament to describe the church. He describes it as a body, as a living organism, where every member has a part to play and is intimately involved in the lives, you know, in the existence of the other members, and knows what's going on, cares about them, and rejoices with them and mourns with them. And I think it's in occasions like this that we really get to see the church live out that calling, and that's a pretty neat thing. Nicole and I have talked a lot about, not just this last week, in fact, primarily in the past, as we talk about things and talk about important things, our faith, and the truth that our feelings are notoriously unreliable indicators of the truth. And in occasions like this, where in the face of something shocking and dramatic, that's no less true. And so while we may feel pain, we may feel anger, even sometimes, we know that nothing about the truth has changed, that God has not changed, that he is who he has always been and always will be, and that is a comforting thing. All right, so 2 weeks ago, in my sermon, we did a recap of everything we've covered in this series on the Pentateuch so far. I promise you it would be a short sermon. And based on the length of my notes, I really thought we were going to come in right around 22 minutes. So you can imagine my surprise when I checked the length of the recording afterward and saw that it was 26 minutes and 49 seconds. Now, on the one hand, this isn't entirely bad because I have a tendency to talk way too fast. And I've been trying to correct that for 29 and a half years now. But it was actually really concerning to me because, first of all, when you've done something for 29 and a half years, that doesn't usually change overnight. And more importantly, though, I'm really just reading up here. I mean, I have this manuscripted word for word, and every once in a while I get lost or I deviate a little, and it's really obvious because I stumble around even more so than usual. So I was like, if I'm up here just reading this and it's taking 5 minutes longer than I think it should, what does that say about what's happening to my reading comprehension? So the thing probably to have done for this sermon would have been to go through and make sure everything was in short, easy words, sort of, you know, channel my inner Biden speechwriter, perhaps. But alas, I did not have time to do that. So all that is to say, I have no idea how long this is going to be. It will be less than 40 minutes, I think. It will be more than 25, and we'll find out. So, again, as I said, 2 weeks ago, we did a recap of everything we've covered up to now. This week, we're going to actually get into some new material, which is great news. So we're going to start by looking at some guidelines for interpreting narrative. After that, we're going to put what we've been learning into practice. We'll examine a narrative passage and then a law passage, first attempting to determine what the author was trying to convey to the original audience, and then we'll consider what lessons we might draw from those passages for us today. So let's jump right in with guidelines for interpreting narrative. It's important that we understand how to interpret narrative because the Pentateuch is primarily narrative. Even those other kinds of literature that appear in the Pentateuch, such as poetry, genealogies, and law, are all embedded within a narrative framework. It's very important that we keep in mind that each narrative is part of a larger story and thus should not be treated as an isolated unit. The creation story is a good example of where we tend to forget this. The main focus of Genesis, as Wendell, I think, mentioned a couple weeks ago, is the history of the patriarchs, not necessarily the account of creation. Genesis 1 and 2 tells us who created all that is and what was created. But the purpose, as Guy pointed out in his sermons, is to portray Yahweh as utterly unlike any of the other supposed gods of the ancient world. Yahweh is a God whose speech is powerful. His words literally bring out of nothing everything that is, and his words shape all of reality. And so all of this helps to set the stage for what will follow the history of the patriarchs. In other words, this supreme being, who is described as the one who brought everything into existence, can and will accomplish his purposes in the world. Thus, when he speaks to Abraham and promises that he will make him a great nation, and that through his descendants all nations will be blessed, we can have every confidence he will bring about what he has promised. We know from the creation account that Yahweh's word is powerful, that he's able to do all that he says he will do. Though the creation account might give us some clues on the how of creation, that is not really its purpose, even though most of the attention it gets focuses on that question. So, every narrative fits into the larger story of Israel's history, and also into the larger story of what we call redemption history, that is, God's plan for the creation itself and the human race. So with that clarification in place, let's look at a few guidelines here. As a disclaimer before we start, these are guidelines, not rules, and this is not a formula per se. These are just principles that will help us hopefully understand narrative passages better. They may or may not all apply to any given passage, and that's okay. So our first guideline for interpreting narrative is to understand the boundaries and context of the passage. I know that we all know this, but it's worth reminding ourselves that the chapters, verses, and even paragraph breaks that we see in our Bibles are not original to the text. They were not inserted by Moses under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, and as such, they are not always accurate or helpful guides to determining where a text begins or ends. What we really want to look for are breaks in the author's thought that give indications that one section of narrative has ended and a new section has begun. Sometimes an author includes words or structural markers that help us identify sections of the text. As an example, within Genesis, the repeated use of the word generations marks various sections of the book. But not every book or section has such obvious markers. For instance, the material on Abraham is contained in one major section that extends from Genesis 11, verse 27, to Genesis chapter 25, verse 11. However, within this section, we can identify a number of self-contained stories, and we have a name for these. Does anybody know what that is? Pericope, very good. I know you've all heard that word here before. It's a good one to be aware of. And on a side note, a Microsoft Word was convinced I was trying to type periscopes. And so if I use periscope at any point this morning, you'll know what happened. We identify sections or pericopes by looking for indications that the author has shifted attention from one narrative cycle to another. Examples of such indicators include major changes in where the action takes place, who is involved, and the nature of the action itself. As an example, we can look at Numbers chapters 12 and 13. Numbers 12 details the rebellion of Aaron and Miriam and ends with Miriam being restored from her leprosy and the Israelites leaving Hazeroth and going to Paran. Numbers 13 begins with God commanding Moses to send spies into the land of Canaan. Clearly, the author has moved on from the rebellion of Miriam and Aaron and into a new section of narrative. So once we understand the boundaries of the passage we're examining, we also want to familiarize ourselves with the context. The material before and after the passage in question can give us insight into the author's train of thought and what the author was trying to convey. A good example of this is the story of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, where Potiphar's wife tries to seduce Joseph and his response is to flee. As Wendell noted previously, oftentimes sermons on this passage focus on the importance of setting up boundaries to avoid sexual temptation. To be clear, that is a very important thing. However, when we examine the larger context, we note that the author's emphasis seems to be on the way God protects and provides for Joseph, not on boundaries and relationships. Boundaries are important, but in this case, the context indicates the author's purpose in including this story is not primarily to teach us about boundaries. Next, we want to consider the relevant details of the passage. There are a number of things to consider here. The first is the plot. Wendell talked a bit about this in one of his earlier sermons, so we won't spend a lot of time on it, but by way of brief reminder, a plot consists of tension that builds until we reach a point of climax, which is where the reader or hearer has questions but no answers. Those questions are then resolved in some way, and focusing or paying attention to the tension and the climax of the passage helps us to see what was important to the author, Likewise, the answers provided during the resolution of the tension give us an indication of what the author was trying to communicate and helps us to avoid reading our concerns into the text. Another detail of the text we might want to consider is characterization. Characterization refers to the kind of information that is provided about the characters in a narrative. There are two types of characterization. Explicit characterization is when the author directly tells us something about the character. For instance, Genesis 39, verse 6 tells us that Joseph was well built and handsome. So I think he and I may have been related. Where implicit characterization is what is conveyed about characters through what they do, what they say, and how others react to them. For instance, Joseph's behavior in Genesis 37, along with the way his brothers react to him and his father even going so far as to rebuke him, suggests that he was kind of a spoiled brat, or at least at that point in time. We also want to consider dialogue. Some authors choose to record what someone said using indirect speech. This is where the author gives us the contents of the speech but does not use the actual words spoken. In contrast, direct speech or dialogue records the actual words spoken. Direct speech tends to leave a much stronger impression on the audience and can help us better understand characters. For instance, Numbers 11 verse 1 tells us, "Now the Israelites complained about their hardships in the hearing of the Lord." This is indirect dialogue. It tells us what the Israelites were saying, but not necessarily the words they were using. Compare this with the direct speech recorded in Numbers 11, verses 4 and 5. "Again, the Israelites started wailing and said, 'If only we had meat to eat. We remember the fish we ate in Egypt at no cost. Also the cucumbers, melons, leeks, onions, and garlic.'" Which leaves more of an impression on you. Finally, we also want to consider stylistic devices. There are a number of these that might be relevant, and they include such things as repetition, irony, and foreshadowing. For instance, repetition is used in Numbers 9 to emphasize Israel's obedience to God's commands. The phrase, "at the Lord's command," appears 7 times in Numbers 9, verses 18 through 23. And this emphasis on Israel's obedience at that time serves to set up a contrast with their complaining in Numbers 11. At this point, having engaged with the details of the text, we are in a position to determine the communicative intention of the author. This entails answering the question, how would this have been understood by the original author and audience? I know I said it earlier, but I want to emphasize again that considering the passage in context is very important. Biblical authors usually did not write isolated narratives that were intended to function as standalone texts. Rather, the biblical writers were responsible for whole books that have coherent themes and messages. So as we're trying to determine how a passage would have been understood by the original audience, we should consider how it fits into the larger message of the chapter, section, and book in which it appears. We mentioned earlier the creation account, and I think this illustrates this point very well. Too often, we read Genesis chapters 1 and 2 as a standalone account, and interpret it in light of the answers we would like it to provide. But what we should do is ask how the creation account fits into the larger context of the rest of the book and how the original audience would have understood it. Once we've carefully analyzed the text and identified, or at least think we've identified, the author's intended meaning, the final step is to consider the text's relevance for us today. Often we try to jump directly to this step of application, but we can only really consider application for ourselves after we have a good understanding of what the original audience would have taken away from the text. Again, as Stuart and Fee put it, a text can never mean what it never meant. There must be a connection between what the author of the text intended to communicate to the original audience and the meaning and application we draw for ourselves today. Vogt terms this process contextualization, and he defines it as the task of applying an author's intended meaning in a different setting, which I think is a good description of what we are ultimately trying to do. All right, so now that we've laid out some guidelines for interpreting narrative, let's look at an example of how we apply them. We're going to look at Genesis chapter 25, verses 19 through 34. This is the account of the birth of Jacob and Esau, and Esau subsequently selling his birthright to Jacob. We don't have time to do a detailed exegesis of this passage, but we're going to work through it and try to apply some of the guidelines we laid out above. Before we get into the passage itself, though, we need to make sure we understand the context. And you'll note we're starting in verse 19 of Genesis 25. However, in this situation, I think it's pretty clear from the text that a new narrative section begins in verse 19. The first 18 verses of Genesis 25 tell us about the final years of Abraham's life and about his descendants. Verse 19 of Genesis 25 begins, "These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son." Note there the use of the word generations, which tends to be an indicator in Genesis that the narrative is shifting. So we have a shift here in focus from Abraham to Isaac and Isaac's descendants. Jacob and Esau are the primary focus of the verses we're going to be looking at today. And then in chapter 26 of Genesis, the author will pick up again with Isaac and God promising to establish him in the oath he swore to Abraham. Okay, so at this point, we're ready to read our passage, so beginning in verse 19 of Genesis 25. "This is the account of the family line of Abraham's son Isaac. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he married Rebekah, daughter of Bethuel the Aramean from Padam Aram, and sister of Laban the Aramean. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was childless. The Lord answered his prayer, and his wife Rebekah became pregnant. The babies jostled each other within her, and she said, 'Why is this happening to me?' So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, 'Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger.' When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. The first to come out was red, and his whole body was like a hairy garment, so they named him Esau. After this, his brother came out with his hand grasping Esau's heel, so he was named Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when Rebekah gave birth to them. The boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was content to stay at home among the tents. Isaac, who had a taste for wild game, loved Esau, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Esau came in from the open country, famished. He said to Jacob, 'Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished.' That is why he was also called Edom. Jacob replied, 'First sell me your birthright.' 'Look, I am about to die,' Esau said. 'What good is the birthright to me?' But Jacob said, 'Swear to me first.' So he swore an oath to him, selling his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau some bread and some lentil stew. He ate and drank and then got up and left. So Esau despised his birthright." All right, there's a lot we could say here, but we're just going to focus on some highlights. First, it's pretty much impossible not to notice that this passage is rife with foreshadowing, beginning with the way Jacob and Esau struggle with each other in the womb. This sets the stage for a rocky, contentious relationship that lasts long after both Jacob and Esau are dead, as the two nations that come from them will continue to have conflict. Note also that Jacob is born grasping Esau's heel. The name Jacob resembles the Hebrew word for heel and also has the connotation of deceiver. To grasp someone by the heel was apparently at that time a figure of speech meaning to deceive. This theme of deception is also going to pop up multiple times throughout the lives of Jacob and Esau. Now, I want to return for a moment to the word that Rebekah receives from the Lord in response to her question about why Jacob and Esau were jostling within her. The response Rebekah receives is, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger." Again, we have here the theme of conflict. But I want to focus on that last line, "the older will serve the younger." Even to us today, I think this strikes us as somewhat out of the ordinary, but to the original audience, this would have been a complete reversal of expectations. Normally, younger brothers were subservient to the firstborn male, who enjoyed special privileges associated with being the firstborn. There's a name for this concept that we've used here before. Does anybody know that? I heard it somewhere. Primogeniture. Wendell's talked about this before, so we're not going to go into detail about it, but we do want to keep in mind that the original audience would have found this reversal of the usual order very noteworthy. We should also note the information we get about Jacob and Esau in verses 27 and 28. We see that Esau is a hunter and spends his time outdoors, so he would have probably fit in very well at this church. On the other hand, Jacob is quiet and apparently keeps to his tent. So we've got one brother who's a skilled hunter and outdoorsman, and one who's sort of a quiet, solitary type, which is interesting because my brother is somehow both of those. The author also tells us that Isaac loved Esau while Rebekah prefers Jacob. Again, we have some definite foreshadowing here, although the events foreshadowed will really start in earnest in chapter 27. So let's move on to this whole birthright selling business. So Esau's been out in the field, possibly hunting, although the text doesn't actually tell us that, and he comes back and is exhausted. Meanwhile, Jacob has a nice stew going, and Esau demands some of the stew, and Jacob seizes the opportune moment to get Esau to agree to sell his birthright. The manner in which Esau so readily agrees to give up his birthright in exchange for stew seems to suggest a certain impetuosity and disregard for his birthright, but just in case we missed this, the author explicitly tells us in verse 34, "So Esau despised his birthright." Again, this willingness to give up his birthright for stew would have been quite shocking to the original audience. We should also note, though, that Jacob doesn't come across as heroic here either, exactly. He's manipulative and starting to live up to his billing as a deceiver, although we're just beginning to see what he's capable of in that area. So there's a lot more we could say about this, but we will sort of pause there for this morning, and let's talk briefly about how we might contextualize this passage for ourselves today. What lessons might we, as 21st century Americans, take away from it? I'm just going to suggest one. We noted how surprising and countercultural it would have been for the original audience that God chose to use Jacob, the younger son, to fulfill the promise he made to Abraham about blessing the whole world through his descendants. They would almost certainly not have been expecting this. But, as we know, God works in ways we can't comprehend and through events we don't expect. And that is still true today. God works in ways we don't understand through events and people we don't expect, and even through actions that are wrong to accomplish his ends. Now, to be really, really clear, I am not suggesting a sort of fatalism that would excuse wrong or sinful actions on the grounds that I guess that was just God's plan. Not at all. But I think one of the main things that would have struck the original audience about this passage is that God is not obligated to accomplish his purposes in the way they would have expected. And that is definitely still true for us today. All right, let's now look briefly at an example of law and how we might apply it today. So we're going to look at Deuteronomy chapter 18, verses 14 through 22. I know Dave covered gave us a brief overview of the entire Pentateuch in one of his sermons, but just as a quick reminder, Deuteronomy is largely a speech or a series of speeches given by Moses to the Israelites just prior to his death and the beginnings of their conquest of the Promised Land under Joshua. So that is the larger context of the passage we're going to be reading. So beginning in verse 14, "The nations you will dispossess, listen to those who practice sorcery or divination. But as for you, the Lord your God has not permitted you to do so. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your fellow Israelites. You must listen to him, for this is what you asked of the Lord your God at Horeb on the day of the assembly, when you said, 'Let us not hear the voice of the Lord our God, nor see this great fire anymore, or we will die.' The Lord said to me, 'What they say is good. I will raise up for them a prophet like you from among their fellow Israelites, and will put my words in his mouth. He will tell them everything I command him. I myself will call to account anyone who does not listen to my words that the prophet speaks in my name. But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, is to be put to death. You may say to yourselves, 'How can we know when a message has not been spoken by the Lord?' If what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. That prophet has spoken presumptuously, so do not be alarmed." So the specific law that we're interested in here is in verse 20. "But a prophet who presumes to speak in my name anything I have not commanded, or a prophet who speaks in the name of other gods, is to be put to death." However, the rest of the passage provides valuable insight into the significance of this law for Israel. As we mentioned, Moses is about to ride off into retirement, and as Moses references in this passage, when the people actually encountered God and heard his voice in Mount Horeb, they were terrified and asked that Moses serve as go-between between them and God. The nations the Israelites are dispossessing use divination and fortune tellers to accomplish this purpose, but the Israelites are prohibited from doing so. Thus, they will need someone new to function in the roles of leader and prophet. But not just anyone should presume to speak for God, far from it. In fact, anyone who falsely claims to speak for God is to be put to death. And that death is the penalty for false prophecies in the Lord's name indicates that this is a very serious offense. One other thing worth mentioning is the criterion given to determine whether a message purportedly from the Lord is in fact from the Lord. The text tells us, if what a prophet proclaims in the name of the Lord does not take place or come true, that is a message the Lord has not spoken. So that's pretty simple. If someone claims something is from the Lord and that thing does not turn out to be true, the message is not from the Lord. Now, I think the baseline understanding of logic in this church is pretty high, so most of you probably already know this, but we should note that this does not imply the opposite. That a false message is not from the Lord does not logically entail that if a message turns out to be true, it is from the Lord. It may be, but it is not necessarily, at least not according to this criterion. So someone could claim a message was from the Lord, and that message could turn out to be true, and this would not definitively demonstrate that the message was from the Lord, at least not according to the criterion laid out here. However, if someone claims a message is from the Lord and the message turns out to be false, we can definitively conclude that the message is not from the Lord. So there's a quick excursus on logic. You're welcome. But returning to the actual command portion of the text, clearly to speak presumptuously and falsely in the name of the Lord was a very big deal for the Israelites. The Lord was concerned to protect his name. That is something that I think is still relevant for us today. Our situation has changed. We are no longer a specific ethnic nation, but as the church, we are still to be an example for God to the world, and to bear false witness about what he has said or what he has done is still something very concerning. Now, we are perhaps not to execute those who falsely claim to speak for the Lord, or at least not usually. But I think the same caution that the Israelites were to show about presuming to speak for God is warranted for us today. We should be extremely hesitant to state definitively what God has said or done beyond where we are explicitly told, for instance, in Scripture. And I realize most of us don't go around proclaiming messages and saying, "Thus saith the Lord." But I think a lot of times we use incautious language, perhaps, that suggests or implies a lot more certainty than is perhaps warranted by what has been revealed to us. And as a note, we do see this sort of caution modeled for us by Paul in his letter to Philemon. So again, by way of very brief reminder, Philemon was a wealthy Christian who lived in Colossae. He had a slave named Onesimus who ran away and fled to Rome, and somehow in Rome, Onesimus met up with Paul and became a Christian, even going on to help Paul during his imprisonment. And Paul would have liked to keep Onesimus, but instead he sends him back to Philemon with a letter of that name that we find in our Bibles. In that letter, after explaining the situation, Paul says to Philemon regarding Onesimus, "Perhaps the reason he was separated from you for a little while was that you might have him back forever, no longer as a slave, but better than a slave, as a dear brother." So did you catch the operative word there? Perhaps. Even Paul, as an apostle who clearly received revelation from God, was unwilling to say definitively this was God's plan in the absence of God telling him so. And how much more so should that be the case for us? All right, so there are all sorts of other interesting things we could take from this passage and from the one previously, but that's for another time. Our purpose today was just to look at how we might apply this command to the Israelites for ourselves today. And with that done, so am I. So thank you for your attention, and And I think Tim will be coming up to close.
Thanks. Good, quick words. So God does it his way, utilizing sinners and degenerates like us to fulfill his purposes. So thanks be to God for his perfect will. Let's stand and I'll close. From Psalm 19, may the words of our mouths and the meditations of our hearts be pleasing to you, O Lord, our rock and redeemer.